Open the Senate Rules Committee for February 18th, 2010, and I will open a public hearing on SB 1028. Yes, Senator Shields, please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent Senate District 22, North and Northeast Portland. And I appreciate you coming back for a second time to discuss Senate Bill 1028 because there have been some important developments in how the Census Bureau is going about answering the question of where should inmates be properly counted for redistricting purposes. As you'll recall, it came before this committee, it seems like months ago, but I think it was probably just a week or 10 days ago, to discuss that very important issue, which is becoming more and more important as Oregon is incarcerating more and more of its citizens. And particularly, I think it's important to get a handle on this, in part for this census, but also to lay the framework for the next census 10 years from now, where, once again, Oregon's incarcerated population is projected to well outpace the growth of the general population. So to recall some of our discussion in the previous time, and to quote Peter Wagner, who presented by phone from the Prison Policy Initiative, he argues, and I agree, that prisoners and inmates are not part of the community of interest that surrounds the prison, and the system of one person, one vote breaks down when we take people from one community of interest and put them in a completely different community of interest, where they, in Oregon, where they're prohibited from staying after they're released, where they are, they cannot vote, and in my view, the result is it ends up giving super representation to those who happen to live near prison and diluted representation to those who may have the unfortunate residence of being in an area that has very high crime rates where a significant portion of that particular community of interest is incarcerated. So as I mentioned in previous testimony, 95% of all inmates will return to their home communities one day, that most inmates commit their crimes in the community of interest that they were living in. Most inmates do not ride up and down the highways committing crime. That's what the research says. And again, they cannot vote. So this is, I believe, just an important issue of fairness. It seems to make sense to me that people should be counted in their home districts as opposed to where they are incarcerated. So the update is that just in the last 10 days, the Census Bureau, and this is noted in the New York Times editorial of February 11th, has decided to speed up its the release of the information to the states of where prisons are and their exact count of what the snapshot of the prison population count earlier in the cycle. And that has spurred some discussion around the other states that while it may be challenging to get people's home addresses to count them in their home districts, the purpose of this hearing also is to introduce an idea that's being fermented around the country as a compromise, which is to say that rather than counting inmates outside of their community of interest in parts of the state where they have no ties, to instead take them out of the census count completely when it comes to redistricting. So the census could potentially do its count, and then the state would then have the option, because of this new policy at the Census Bureau, of pulling people out of the count altogether. And I thought it was important to come before this body and introduce this idea because I'm not certain if the chair wants to act on this today, but I wanted to make sure that if we decided to pursue this in 2011, that no one felt that this was an idea that snuck up on anybody. So particularly in a district like Senator Farioli's, where about over 5,000 people are incarcerated, I wanted to make sure that this body had the chance to discuss it in the public forum, and that it would rightfully be brought in front of the people of Oregon. I'd be happy to also discuss the Dash 5 and Dash 9s now, Mr. Chair,
yes,
if you'd like
please,
me to.
Yes, please do so.
So you have in front of you the Dash 5 amendment, which was a concept brought to us by the League of Cities, because as we also found out through their testimony, there was concern, particularly from Oregon's smaller municipalities, that this would affect money. And I think that was a fair concern. We found out through testimony that Pendleton could, if this was about money and we were going to affect population count as for state formulas, that they could lose $100,000 in formula for roads and the shared revenues from everything from liquor to, I believe, tobacco taxes as well. So I said, no, that's not the intention of this bill, so why don't we go ahead and amend it and get it put into the bill. That's what the Dash 5s do, a concept introduced by the League of Cities. Go on to Dash 9?
Yes.
The Dash 9 amendment, as you recall from previous testimony, the Department of Corrections says, you know, this is going to be a little more complicated than we thought it was going to be. It's going to cost us about $200,000. So the Dash 9 introduces this new idea being fomented around the country, which is that we might want to consider taking inmates out of the count for redistricting purposes altogether. And that's what the Dash 9 does, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Shields. I'm actually familiar with both amendments. So, questions for Senator Shields?
Mr. Chair, thank you. It seems to me that this kind of goes hand in hand with the requirement we have that people go back to their own communities after they get out of prison. Do most states have this, do you know, that requirement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's a good question. I do not know if that's the case, but it certainly isn't the case in Oregon that inmates are required to go back to their county where they were, where their crime was committed.
Because it seems to me, and the money, I don't know how you separate the legislative, you know, the redistricting from the money, because as I understand that there are federal funds that do get allocated on the basis of population. And that this, the prison population is, just the very nature of it, is a population that is going to tend to be more demanding of services, government services, even when they get out of prison, whether it be, you know, parole and probation, drug treatment, or whatever. And there's a federal funding aspect to many of those. So this amendment that you have, the Dash 5, I don't understand what the effect of it would be, because isn't counting the people by its nature going to affect the funding?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's a good question. The census count will remain the census count, and that's primarily what is used to handle any type of funding issues at the federal level. And at the state level, there are fewer funding streams associated with population than one might think, but there are some. And that had some concerns for the League of Cities. I think the argument can be made that because these institutions are in these communities, you need to have infrastructure built to get people to the prisons. There need to be roads, highways maintained to get people there. And that's an argument that's been made. And so I thought to assuage their concern that this was about money, that the amendment is something that I'd be comfortable with.
Okay. So basically you're endorsing the approach of just not counting prisoners at all.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I do think that that is a reasonable compromise at this point. It makes sure that people who live near a prison, and I have one in my district, don't get super representation, and those who come from areas that have high crime rates won't have their representation diluted. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Senator Farioli, I can see in the eyes.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Shields and I had... I think
representative.
I mean, I'm so sorry. I beg your pardon, Senator Shields and I had a spirited discussion about this issue, and we do disagree. And for the following reasons, I think Senator Burdick's point is well made. The dollars do follow the census count. And the thing, the social services nets in the communities that serve prisons are strained, as they are everywhere, but they are burdened again by the relatively higher needs for social services in folks that are incarcerated. So, you know, we don't necessarily see a disproportionality in having federal dollars particularly appropriated by census tract. That seems to make sense. People need services where they are, not where they came from. And when they go back to their communities, of course, they will rejoin that census block. The other issue that may sort of be under the radar, which has a particular import for those of us that come from rural areas, is that the Ninth Circuit has just discerned that since minority populations are overrepresented among prison populations, that there is a civil rights issue in denying incarcerated inmates the right to vote, and that right has been restored. That decision is subject to appeal, so we haven't found a final determination. But if we count folks in their home district, then what also gets skewed, in addition to the dollars, which should follow the inmate, will be the census tract for voting, for redistricting, and for apportionment. So what happens under Senator Shields' bill is that the urban area will have several thousand folks added to their voter rolls in areas that already have a high concentration of representation, and the urban areas will lose population, having the unintended consequence of likely making the urban districts larger. And, you know, 5,000 people moved out of, say, District 30 would be the equivalent of Sherman and Wheeler County. So the district that I represent, which is currently 34,000 square miles, could go to, oh, say, 40,000 square miles. And so those consequences are simply untenable. The loss of dollars to the social services network, where the inmates are incarcerated, because that's where the services are needed, and the future redistricting possibilities and the apportionment issues, you know, the apportionment meaning not only for voting but for federal dollars, and redistricting makes this bill a very, very bad idea for rural communities wherein prisons are housed. I would be referring to Baker County, where Snake River Correctional Institution, where Powder River is located, and Ontario, where we have facilities. Snake River Correctional Institution would be another one that has similar implications. It just seems to me to be perhaps a legitimate concern of the senators for urban areas, but I think those are overshadowed by the legitimate concerns of rural communities that where in these facilities are located.
Mr. Chair? And
Senator Farrell, had you complete
that's it, Mr. Chair.
I wanted to respond to that point you just made, because it's not my understanding that people in prison, while they're in prison, actually use the social services. I mean, do you know how that works? I mean, do they use I thought that the prison population, while they're incarcerated, was pretty much self-contained and are not consumers of those particular dollars, and maybe I'm mistaken.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I believe that's right. Almost all the money in the Department of Corrections is from the general fund. And if I could respond, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, to Senator Farrelly's concern, there's really no telling how redistricting might play out. The legislature or the Secretary of State, as the case may be, depending on what happens in the next election cycle, or a potential ballot measure that might change the process, could decide to take a swath of an urban area to make it part of this district, and could result in constriction of a potentially large district as well.
Mr. Chairman?
Anything additional? Senator?
Just two observations. Prisons are heavy users of social services. And the Department of Corrections, although it is funded from the general fund, is a contractor for alcohol and drug counseling, social services, mental health social services, a whole panoply of social services get contracted for. And those services are supported not only by the contract income from the incarceration community, but also from the low-income community, from federal appropriation, from grants, you know, based on the population served in all sorts of different ways. So you can say that these direct services are all provided by the general fund through the Department of Correction, but that ignores all the ancillary services that come. And the other issue for Senator Shields is that the apportionment requirements in the Constitution are one person, one vote. So notwithstanding the redistricting vagaries, you know, whether it's done by the legislature or the Secretary of State, the population, the raw population numbers are what determines the size of the district. So, you know, although we can't look in the crystal ball and determine what the redistricting maps will look like, we will know that the population of Senate districts will be approximately the same. That means my district gets bigger. Urban districts get smaller. That concentrates political power in the urban areas.
Senator Shields.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, I think that the one-person, one-vote idea is case law, and I also wanted to note the handout that I think you all have, page looking at how other states have deviated from the census for redistricting purposes and how the courts have upheld that. In particular, the Supreme Court of Oregon, as many of you know, has held that the Secretary of State is not obligated to rely on census data in apportioning districts in Hartung versus Bradbury, which I believe was the case related to the federal institution in Sheridan. Indeed, it held that the Secretary of State violated the Oregon Constitution by failing to make corrections to federal census data to place a prison population, and said that you must place that population in the correct census block.
Okay. Any additional? Seeing none, thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is an issue that is rightly to be debated, and I just wanted to make sure it didn't sneak up on anybody. Thank you.
Close that public hearing. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1056. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview, and could Senator Winters come forward?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1056 directs the Legislative Assembly to review state agencies and programs, taxes and fees administered by state agencies every 6 years. It establishes a Sunset Advisory Commission to review and evaluate the state agencies and the programs, the taxes and fees administered by them, and make recommendations on the abolishing continuation of agencies and programs. It abolishes state agencies that are not continued by a legislative act following the review of the agency by the Sunset Commission. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator, please state your name for the record, and could you educate the committee as to the purposes of the bill that you sponsored?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. For the record, my name is Jackie Winters. I'm the senator that represents Senate District 10. I reside in Salem, Oregon, the seat of the Capitol. Senate Bill 1056, in setting out the purpose for this bill, I think this session we've grappled with a lot, the growth of government. And today, Senate Bill 1056 is just asking the government to slow down, and this bill provides a vehicle for us to put the taps a little bit on the brakes. I think we need to take time to review programs we have put in place and verify that they're still performing as they were originally intended when the legislature adopted the particular legislation or the measure. This bill requires that new legislation before the Oregon Legislative Assembly that authorizes or establishes a program, tax or fee, contain a sunset date of not more than 6 years after the enactment of the legislation. legislators would be required to continuously examine the sunset date through legislation if they wanted the program to continue. I find it interesting that we never go back and really revisit, you know, only if we do it through audit or we do it through some other vehicle. The date of the extension would be determined by the legislature, but not exceed 10 years. And finally, the legislation would establish a Sunset Advisory Commission who would be charged with reviewing and evaluating state agency programs, taxes, and fees that are administered by the state. Simply put, this measure is simply brought to you, and it's about accountability, and it's about the growth of government and how we need to have a vehicle to actually revisit those programs and those measures that we have put in place years ago, and often we do not do that. I have pondered this whole question of our role in looking at programs and looking at them in a way, are they still necessary? If what we did 10 years ago, is that still relevant today? And that is the purpose and the genesis of Senate Bill 1056, and I'm open for any question that you may have.
Okay. Any questions for Senator Winters? Any questions at all?
She?
I think you convinced everybody.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Devlin. I'm sure that you will know about, you've been here almost as long as I have.
Yeah, but you have many more decades of experience than I do.
I just kind of noted that, I think.
He's chronological.
Yeah. Is there anyone else to testify on that bill? Okay. I will close the public hearing. I'm actually going to go. Can you get Senator Burdick?
Yep.
I'm going to open a work session on SJR 48A. Senator Burdick, you have a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -A2 amendments to SJR 48A.
Okay, Senator Burdick has moved to adopt the -A2 amendments to Senate Joint Resolution 48A. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can we have a discussion of the purpose of the A2 amendment, please?
Yes, the A2 amendment, just being extremely straightforward, is the equivalent of SJR 44 that had a hearing earlier in this committee, and SJR 48 has already had a hearing in its original form before this committee.
But the purpose of SJR 48, Mr. Chair, what does it do?
SJR 48, the underlying bill.
The A2 amendment.
The A2 amendment basically makes SJR 48 the equivalent of SJR 44. Replaces amendment, proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to create Article 11P that would allow the state of Oregon to incur general obligation indebtedness to finance or refinance costs associated with real or personal property that is or will be owned or operated by the states, permit state to incur indebtedness to finance costs of acquiring, constructing, remodeling, repairing, equipping, or furnishing real or personal property that is or will be used, owned, or operated by the state, including facilities and systems, sub-B, infrastructure related to real or personal property, or sub-C, indebtedness incurred pursuant to Section 7, Article 11, refers proposed amendment to the people for their approval at the next regular general election.
And, Mr. Chairman, I see that there's a fiscal impact statement.
Yes, there
is. Can we have the discussion of the fiscal impact statement, Mr.
Chairman? Yes, we can. Yes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, the fiscal impact, as you can see, is approximately, in terms of general fund dollars, is $38,000, and we have a letter from the Senate President putting a subsequent referral on 48A.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that the A2 amendment is identical to the SJR 44.
That's correct.
And did we have a discussion of the fiscal impact of SJR 44?
Yes, it's exactly the same as for SJR 48.
But SJR 44 did not have a referral to Ways and Means.
That's correct. It should have had a referral to Ways and Means because it actually had a fiscal impact. And we could have avoided all of this if it had had such a subsequent referral.
Avoided all this consideration of the fiscal impact.
Yes.
I see. Mr. Chair, does that mean that the bill will be referred from the floor to the Ways and Means Committee?
Not necessarily. No decision has been made at this time about SJR 44.
Well, I gather, I guess, Mr. Chairman, I have to observe that the redundant nature of the A2 amendments would seem to be a pointless exercise in that the bill's already headed for the floor. And the fiscal impacts must already have been disclosed. They are, in fact, listed in the, and it is under $50,000, I think.
Yes.
Why are we doing this?
Senator Farioli, as you well know, although this figure of $50,000 is often cited, there are many occasions, I actually have another bill in Ways and Means that was directly referred there that has a fiscal impact of $40,000. So the Senate President has put the subsequent referral on it, and so that's where we are.
And Mr. Chairman, I think everyone on this committee knows, but I think we should let the folks listening at home understand, and those here that may not understand, that the A2 amendments, I believe, are simply designed to cause the subsequent referral to be justified, which would prevent the addition of a minority report. So essentially, this is a tool for silencing an opportunity for the minority party to bring better public policy to the Senate floor for discussion. And I realize others may have another opinion about the purpose of the A2 amendment. But I will point out, since the A2 amendment is a bill that will already and has already been scheduled for a hearing on the Senate floor, that it's utterly unnecessary and completely redundant, and that the only purpose is to prevent the attachment of a minority report to this bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farioli, and I respectfully disagree.
Yes, I would expect so.
Okay. We have a motion on the floor to adopt the Dash A2 amendments. Any additional discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I appreciate the gamesmanship of this particular measure. I do believe it to be somewhat redundant, and I would categorize the amendment as sneaky, sneaky, sneaky. But other than that, Mr. Chairman, I applaud you on your straight face, and this ups the ante.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. I'll take that as a compliment.
Yes, I would. It was meant as a compliment.
Okay. We have a motion. Any additional discussion? Will you call the roll on the motion?
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Mesker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli?
No.
Chair Devlin?
Aye. Motion passes. I don't have to do this, but is there anyone that wants to comment during this work session? I am permitted to actually ask for comments from the audience. Seeing no one raising their hand, I will actually go to the next motion. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Joint Resolution 48A as amended with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Is there any additional discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Motion to table.
Okay. Senator Atkinson has moved to table. Not debatable. Let's call the roll.
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Mesker?
No.
Vice Chair Farioli?
Aye.
Chair Devlin?
No. Motion's defeated. To the main motion.
Mr. Chair, this is a good bill, should pass.
Okay. Any additional discussion?
Mr. Chairman, all I can say is that there are, at least up until seconds ago, there were two very relieved people sitting in the back of this chamber who had an interest in assisting some folks with the main body of the bill. So,
okay.
But I will be voting no, and I will be serving notice of intent to file a minority report.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Under discussion, can I ask for a 1 minute recess with my colleague?
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Ferrioli, reading from some notes I've been provided here, based on prior decisions in the Senate, known minority reports can be filed with the committee report if the measure has a subsequent referral. This also pertains to the addition of a subsequent referral under Senate Rule 8.40. I will take note of your notice, but it probably has no effect.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, it was merely our intent to put on the record our a desire to file a minority report, and it was also our intention to put on the record the chairman's intention to strip that minority report out. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. To the main motion.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm grasping straws, but motion to adjourn.
Yes, that's actually the next one you can do.
No. I think I can make that motion now.
No, I said that. That's the next motion that you could do. I've done these.
Mr. Chairman, it's a point of clarification.
Yes.
I think we have a motion on the table.
Yes, we do.
Thank
motion
you.
To adjourn. Could you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Metzger?
No.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
Aye.
Chair Devlin?
No. Motion fails. Okay, to the main motion. Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
No.
Chair Devlin?
Aye. Motion passes. Senate Bill 48A, as amended, is on its way to the Ways and Means Committee.
And, Mr. Chairman, even though the motion may be of no effect, I have voted no, and I am serving notice of intent to file a minority report.
Okay.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, this is the only institution in Oregon where sneaky, sneaky, sneaky is an approbation. So congratulations.
That was something.
Senator Ferrioli, I spent my final two terms in the House as a vice chair of rules on minority side, and my side, my job was to figure out every potential procedural motion I could make, and to decide in moments, literally in moments, whether or not we would oppose an amendment that was still warm and was 40 pages long.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Given that very kind lecture of your experience, What other opportunities did I just miss? I don't think
I did. Yeah, you missed it. You could have deferred to a time certain.
You're killing me. Shit.
You may get another opportunity.
Where's Roger Byer when you need him?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Just in conclusion on that discussion of procedural.
Yes.
Motions. It's our intention to leave no stone unhurled.
Understood, Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just for those listening at home, the good nature of this discussion, I think, is a reflection of every single member here, as I look down the aisle, has served both in the minority and in the majority.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may go just slightly further than our good colleague, Senator Burdick, I think it shows the tremendous respect that we have for each other in this process.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. We'll now go to our final bill, which is, I think, actually why all the people, most of the people here have been waiting.
Do we have any other work sessions?
No,
but there's nothing more entertaining than this going on in this building right now.
Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3624. Representative Holy, will you come forward? And then we will go to the rest of the public testimony.
We don't have any more.
Well, at least, Mr. Chairman, it's a non-controversial bill.
Okay. And Representative Holvey, the intent here is to hold the public hearing, and just so people know, the Rules Committee at this stage functions in a somewhat unusual fashion. We'll hold the public hearing, but if this comes up for a work session, that may happen. That may happen in a two-minute period, if it comes
up.
Well, with an hour's notice, it may happen. The work session may last all of 2 minutes.
Yep.
So, Representative Holvey, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate this opportunity to speak on House Bill 3624A, a bill that I sponsored and have been working on for several months. Just a little background on the bill itself. The federal government last spring, I believe, passed a requirement called the Home Valuation Code of Conduct, which was an agreement between the state of New York's Attorney General and Fannie Mae. And the purpose of that was to create a buffer between lenders and appraisers to try to maintain some a better integrity of that industry. And I might say that, in my opinion, that particular federal requirement has basically turned this industry upside down and caused a great deal of instability in the appraisal industry itself. And has caught my attention last summer, and in discussing it with some of my colleagues on the other side, Representative Kinnemer and a few others, I decided that it was actually important enough of an issue to bring forward in this February session, simply because appraisers in this state are being squeezed out of the market and are leaving the market because they cannot afford to stay in it. And they're under substantial pressure from these AMCs to deliver appraisals that oftentimes would, by necessity of the requirements put on them by the appraisal management companies, that don't lack the accuracy and the integrity that the industry has actually stood for and actually has requirements by law and by their own standards to uphold. So it's with that I bring this bill to the Senate side with some great urgency, I believe. Not just for the appraisal industry itself, but for consumers as well. Appraisal management companies have also been raising their fees to the point where they're making sometimes more than the appraiser is, and the appraiser is now oftentimes making half of what they were making a couple of years ago. And albeit that is a reason that you'll see many of them are leaving the industry because they simply can't afford to stay in business anymore. So that it's with that background that this bill has come forward. I've been working on this issue, as I said, since last summer, and engaged the Appraisal Licensure Board in the fall, and have held a hearing on this bill in our January legislative days, and have met with stakeholders many times on this particular issue. And you know, the bill that you see before you today is actually somewhat of a compromise. There's many pieces that I wanted to put in it that didn't come out. I will note that I did have a surety bond required of appraisal management companies in a previous draft that due to negotiations I took it out. I still think it's a good idea. The state of Washington just this week passed legislation that does require a surety bond, and other states have passed legislation similar to that that also require surety bonds of the appraisal management companies. I'm passing out, I believe your committee administrator is also passing out several, a smattering of some emails that I pulled from my file. I've received over 70 emails from appraisers across the state in support of this legislation and telling me why, and for various reasons that I think will become apparent from others in the testimony. So it's been a long process. I had a lot of collaboration in my committee from my colleagues on both sides of the aisle. We actually had an amendment that failed by one vote to outlaw appraisal management companies in the state of Oregon. I thought it might have been a little bit far-reaching to do that, and was a little worried about the ramifications that that might have long-term, but it certainly would have solved a few problems that we saw. I've also distributed another amendment, -5 amendment, to you, which I believe also would help solve this problem, but perhaps needs to be discussed further. But it's in the amendment, it's the same basic bill that's before you, except that it includes a cap on what appraisal management companies can charge. Appraisal management companies sort of operate as a broker, or they buy and sell appraisals. And I'm not sure whether a commission is appropriate for them or whether they're just free to do 100% plus markups on the cost of an appraisal. And the disturbing part about this is that appraisal management companies now, the figures I've seen are between 60 and 80% of the appraisals done in the nation and in the state of Oregon are now coming through these appraisal management companies, many of which are owned by large joint ventures owned by many of the large lenders and banks, which seems a little bit odd. And being that they're out of state, they're taking the orders from the appraisals in state. And Senator Burdick may appreciate this, and then basically hiring Oregon appraisers to do the work, and the lenders that are paying out of state aren't paying any taxes on what revenue that we used to get because we used to hire appraisers directly. And so this middleman, out-of-state middleman, now is you know, I would say charging for their service, but also siphoning off quite a substantial amount from individual independent contractor appraisers, which are operating throughout our industry. There's also some great concern on the quality of the appraisals that come through these appraisal management companies, especially when they're out of state, because appraisals also look at they're geographically specific for the appraisals that are, you know, familiar with the community that they live in and the valuations in that community. It's very important that they have that kind of geographic competence, and quite frankly, a large corporation in Florida or in Minnesota or California may not know the difference between Burns and Lake Oswego, so that has created a bit of a problem for the industry in making sure that they do have quality appraisals. This is an important issue for not just the industry, as I said, but for consumers to be able to have reliable appraisals for the valuation of their properties, and also the issue of the cost of the appraisal now is somewhat being controlled, and we're noticing a rise in the cost of the appraisals to consumers at a time when the appraisers are actually getting less. And I would note, you know, I'm sure there's that there's a large coalition of appraisers, you know, that are supporting this bill, the American Society of Appraisers and the Oregon chapter of the American Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisals. the Oregon chapter of the National Association of Independent Fee Appraisers, all of which are supporting this bill. The Appraisal Licensure Board has also come out in support of this bill. There's been much discussion about whether or not the Appraisal Licensure Board is the right agency to oversee this regulation of appraisal management companies. I met with Corey Streisinger from the Department of Consumer and Business Services trying to convince her that maybe their agency should take this on, and I met with them at least three times on this issue. And they kept coming back and saying, we really don't have the expertise, because what this bill deals with is actually ensuring the quality of appraisers, and that the management of the appraisals by these management companies doesn't undermine the integrity of the appraisal itself, and felt that they just don't have the expertise to do that, and that the licensure board may be better suited than they. And I would actually concur with that after looking at some of the other regulation that has been passed in other states. And I will note that most of the and this bill included, has been modeled after a national model legislation that's come forward. And I think it's very well thought out. Again, I think there's some pieces that could be added into it, but with deference to, you know, moving a little bit more slowly on this, I did negotiate many of those pieces out. I think a disclosure might be nice to what the appraisal management company is actually paying the appraiser, but that came out, the bond, and of course the fee cap that I mentioned. And there were several other pieces that came out with the realtors had concerns about in this. And there's a lot of specifics in this bill, but it's not real complicated, and I appreciate your an opportunity to speak. I know there will be others that may be able to speak more specifically to some of the legislation, but I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Any questions for Representative Holder?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick. Thank you. This is a new issue to me, but I've had appraisers from my district come and visit me about this. What problem was being addressed in creating these appraisal management? In other words, why did they not exist before? Why do they exist now? What problem caused them to come into being?
Senator Burdick, a good question. There are some that have been around for quite some time. There's actually a letter of support for this bill from an appraisal management company from Lori Egan, who operates an independent appraisal management company in the state of Oregon, relatively small compared to the large corporate style. And, you know, they've been around for a while, but what really spurred the advent of the proliferation of the use of these appraisal management companies by lenders is the home valuation code of conduct that I mentioned that Fannie Mae and the state of New York agreed to try to basically protect, I guess, the integrity of the industry from, you know, hitting the number, or, you know, setting a valuation, saying we need this valuation to close this deal. This is the value we want, and you know, that oftentimes led to overinflated values that then consumers would get into loans where their property was essentially not worth as much as the loans they had on them, and that helped contribute some to some of the subprime issues and some of the mortgage crisis issues that we had. And so that was what led to this discussion. But the problem is that there's, you know, the appraisers, you know, at least in the state of Oregon and several other states, have pretty strict standards already in place. And so there are no standards to prevent the appraisal management companies from, you know, operating in the way that they were trying to prevent appraisers from operating. And so that's kind of what happened. And so there's no regulation on these appraisal management companies. There's no standards they have to live up to in federal or state law right now. I know the federal government is looking at this issue right now, but I really feel it's incumbent that we act now, because a year from now, if we sit around and wait, you know, the appraisal industry will largely disappear, and will go to the lowest common denominator for the production of appraisals.
And Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, what is it about the current situation that's causing appraisers to make less money? Are they getting paid less per appraisal, or is there just less business?
Well, I would, appraisers can probably answer that better than I, but it's my understanding that, appraisers have pretty much a set fee for what it takes to do an appraisal, just because the economy has gone down, that they would substantially lower their appraisals. The problem is the appraisal management companies solicit appraisers to go to work on their panels. And in that solicitation, they have a fee schedule and say, we want to have appraisals done in 48 hours, and we're going to pay you $200 for them. And appraisers used to be collecting $450, $500 for those same appraisals. And if they don't accept those terms and produce the outcome that the appraisal management company wants to be able to satisfy the lender for being able to close a loan, I would suspect, they don't use them. And so they're basically squeezed out of the market. And if they're controlling 80% of the appraisals in the market, that's, bordering on a restraint of trade almost, I would think. But I'm not really a restraint of trade attorney or anything like that. But, yeah, I mean, it seems very egregious to me, and that's why I decided to bring this forward in the February session instead of waiting till the end. And like I say, it is somewhat negotiated out. I really think putting a cap on what they can charge, like realtors, collect 6% on a commission, and I think the -5 amendment that I submitted to you allows them to charge 10% of what the appraiser charges, 10% above what the appraiser charges. But my colleagues were a little nervous about going forward with that, and I can understand why, because we don't know exactly how much that business model of appraisal management companies really needs to do their work, I suppose, of buying and selling appraisals. I don't know, how difficult of a process that is.
Any additional? Yes, Senator Farioli.
Mr. Chairman, I think just a point of clarification, it's my understanding that real estate commissions are entirely negotiable between the listing agency and the seller. So I don't know that there's we assume it's a certain amount, but I don't think there's anything other than the going rate on the open market. And Mr. Chairman, the question I have is, this just shows my lack of understanding about the board that we're discussing. Mr. Chairman, I don't know who to ask, but where is the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board currently housed? Is that in the Real Estate Division?
I believe it's an independent board, if I may.
Okay.
And it does have a public member on it, a member from the banking industry as well. So, and I believe there's somebody here from the board that it may be testifying that can answer those specifics for you.
Yeah, well, at one point in time, I think the Real Estate Division did license appraisers.
As well as, yes.
And then appraisers were required to work through a licensed broker. And the broker was subject to audit and all of the other requirements and rules of the real estate industry. And it seems to me that we're duplicating this model that already exists currently in the real estate laws, but it's been some time since I've been very familiar with those laws, and I certainly see a compelling need. And I appreciate Representative Holvey bringing the issue.
Thank you, and I do know that the appraisal licensure used to be handled by the real estate agency or a real estate board, but that they broke away. And as a matter of fact, they used to be housed in the Department of Consumer Business Services at one time too.
Right.
And so they've been all over for sure. But I don't know that this is duplicative as such. Nobody else really handles that.
Mr. Chairman, I don't mean duplicative necessarily. Just the model is one. For instance, real estate brokers have a code of ethics, a resolution process, audit requirements, reporting requirements, fiduciary responsibilities, clients' trust accounts. All of that is disclosable, at the request of the commission. And it seems that is a model that may have some application in this.
Yes. And I believe the appraisal board operates similarly, but I'll let them speak for themselves.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you very much for your time and your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Holvey. I'm going to call people up in groups here. So let's see. Ms. Gillespie, Mr. Royer, and Mr. Zell. And please start in whatever order you would like to.
I can go first.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Thank you very much. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Roxanne Gillespie. I am the owner, I'm a real estate appraiser, and I'm the owner of Gillespie and Associates in Eugene, Oregon. And I want to share with you the great support that real estate appraisers have for House Bill 3624-A. Excuse me while I put on my reading glasses. And I also would like to thank Representative Holvey for bringing this legislation forward. It did pass on the House floor with a 58-2 vote. And I also would like to request that written testimony be entered into the record for Rodney Hess, Michael Reed, and John Barnett. They are unable to attend this meeting. They live in various parts of Oregon. John Barnett lives in Florence, and it was next to impossible to get him here. So I'd like to be able to allow that entered into testimony. The need for House Bill 3624-A has become apparent in Oregon and elsewhere as we've been experiencing constrictions of recent government responses to the collapse of the real estate market. The Home Valuation Code of Conduct is the result of a joint agreement made in March 2008 between Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Federal Housing Finance Agency, as well as the New York State General Attorney General, to enhance the independence and accuracy and objectivity of real estate appraisers and the appraisal process. So the Home Valuation Code of Conduct set up a firewall, which is the appraisal management companies, the AMCs, and I apologize for all the acronyms, they can get confusing. And it's the firewall is between the lenders and the appraisers. And so there's a chart that we've also given in our testimony that shows that the lender will contact the appraisal management company. The appraisal management company then contacts the appraiser. And the purpose of that is to foster the independence and the objectivity that is allowed in the appraisal process. However, the code, Home Valuation Code of Conduct, has led to unforeseen consequences for purchasers, property owners, lenders, appraisers, and others involved in the sale of real estate. Since the implementation of HBCC, the majority of appraisal assignments for lending purposes are now placed through the AMCs. And I believe a number to that was 80% now are placed through AMCs. I want to bring to your attention that AMCs are currently the only unregulated entity in the real estate chain. Banks, mortgage lenders, title companies, real estate agents, real estate appraisers, we're all required to have licensing, registration. Appraisers are required to have education. For many in the industry, this has been a harsh disruption. The line of communication has been broken since there are minimal education for AMCs, and too often the lack of real estate knowledge on the part of the AMC can lead to poor results for the consumer. Real estate appraisers are required to have a college degree, to have additional education in appraisal courses and appraisal theory. We also have to have work experience with a peer or a supervisory appraiser. I believe it's 3,000 hours and 4,000 hours. And we also have to take a comprehensive examination in order to be licensed to practice appraisal in our state. In my testimony, I also state in the written testimony that a lot of the appraisal management companies have devalued what appraisers do in the anticipation of creating more activity for turning the appraisals out quickly. And Representative Hovey spoke to that issue as well, that appraisers used to be able to charge $400 to $450 for residential appraisals. Now they are down to $200, $225 in some areas of our state. There are circumstances in Oregon in which Oregon appraisers have not been paid by the appraisal management company. And I believe there is testimony by Michael Reed that speaks to that, that he has not been paid by an appraisal management company. At the federal level, Congress recognized that problems exist, and House Resolution 1728 passed the House in 2009, which requires states to register and regulate appraisal management companies in the public interest. Real estate appraisers work from comparables, which are comparisons of similar houses and properties that have sold in surrounding neighborhoods. Frequently, an appraisal management company will select an appraiser based on the lowest bid rather than on experience with certain types of property or geographic knowledge. Then, as Representative Hovey spoke to, the AMC may require reduced turnaround time, which can adversely affect the accuracy of the appraisal report because it affects the research needed and the ability to verify data. So this could have financial ramifications for consumers. Thirdly, I'd like to point out that real estate agents have to take the time, or we ask that they take the time, to help appraisers with the comparable sales. And if the appraiser is coming from out of an area that is not familiar with the marketplace, there is a burden placed upon real estate agents to help educate appraisers of that particular marketplace. House Bill 3624A requires appraisal management companies to register with the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board and establishes standards for appraisal management companies practicing in Oregon. Six states have already adopted very similar regulation, and that's outlined in my testimony. As the Coalition of Oregon Appraisers, we strongly urge the committee to carefully consider this bill and vote yes. I thank you for your attention, and I am happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions? Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Craig Zell. I reside in Beaverton, Oregon. I have offices there. I am a certified appraiser by the states of Washington and Oregon, and have been since licensing became Oregon law some 20 years ago and was taken out of the real estate agency's purview. I've been in the profession for 28 years. I currently serve as the chair of the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board, although I'm here as a citizen to urge you to vote yes on this bill. You've heard the testimony. I don't need to reiterate all of the ramifications of the bill, but just to say that events of the past year or two have made me believe it is now imperative that this legislation be passed. The bill is similar to others adopted in six other states and currently pending in some 20 other states. I assume that you've heard the testimony, you've read the bill, so I won't go through all my testimony. You have it in writing. I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I may break in for just a moment.
Yes.
I have pressing business elsewhere in the building. I appreciate that Representative Holby brought the issue. Like Senator Burdick, I'm learning on a fairly steep learning curve here. So I didn't want the members of the panel to believe I was just walking out on their hearing.
Thank you.
The only admonition I would leave is for the chairman of the licensure board. Be careful what you ask for.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could just ask a kind of a technical question. You made the point that there's no particular educational requirement or something for the AMCs. Can the AMCs do the appraisals themselves with no licensure? Do they have to have an actual appraiser do the appraisals?
Appraisers in Oregon, or appraisals in Oregon, must be done by certified or licensed appraisers. Mm-hmm. So the answer is no, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so basically they're a clearinghouse to kind of arrange the appraisals. I guess I'm trying to figure out how they fit in this.
Mr. Chair, Senator, what it really is a firewall between the loan processing and the appraisal process itself. It's for the protection, really, of the banking system and the consumer.
And between, how does that firewall work? I mean, are they supposed to make independent judgment on the quality of the appraisal when they don't have any training?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a good question. In the past, we don't know how much training they've had to review the quality or the competency of appraisers or appraisals. So this bill would promote that that issue. And if I may add, this is an enabling legislation, and the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board will be holding public hearing to adopt administrative rules.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, just a final question. Apparently there have been longstanding appraisal management companies in Oregon, and it hasn't been a problem. What's different now?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's really the proliferation of those AMCs. Mm-hmm. And the ones we don't know exist that are coming in from other states and are being formed in Oregon itself.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Actually, just an appraisal question out of curiosity. Since it's been a long time since I've had one done, are appraisals usually done after building inspections or before?
Mr. Chairman, a building inspection is not necessarily required before or after an appraisal is done. The appraisal is really for the valuation of a property in its highest and best use, and a building inspection is to determine the adequacy of the components, if you will.
Okay. The reason I ask the question is I have had a few instances with constituents who have made residential purchases, and the appraisals have been probably accurate for the type of residence that it is and the neighborhood that it's in and the general how it would equate to other properties in the area. But while most times in building inspections you detect things, not always, but sometimes there can be things that are rather dramatic that are not visible in terms of its impact on the value of the property, particularly the improvements to the property. So, please proceed.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Carl Royer. I'm a certified residential appraiser in Oregon and Washington, and have been for almost 20 years, and I'm president of the Portland Rose City chapter of NIFA, the National Association of Independent Fee Appraisers. And Representative Holvey was quite informative and eloquent, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to be give you a very condensed version of the written testimony that you have from me. The task before us is to protect the consumer. And the most compelling argument is that for this legislation is that all other entities in the process are regulated and or registered, some with educational requirements, except AMCs. The HVCC, or Home Valuation Code of Conduct, which mandates the use of AMCs, came about as a result of Washington Mutual influencing the appraiser selection process with an AMC, E-Appraise-It, who did cave, this is public knowledge, who caved under pressure in order to keep their client, if that sounds familiar to you. The Attorney General, Cuomo, then decided that this structure, using AMCs as a buffer between the lender and the appraiser, was a great business model and should be expanded to as many appraisals as possible. Somewhat like arresting a bank robber and then making him a guard. Now the majority of lending appraisals use the same system. It should be noted that there has long been a federal statute forbidding appraisal pressure and providing a $10,000 per occurrence fine, but there's no enforcement mechanism for appraisers and consumers to access this. Imagine an appraiser going to the FBI and saying, my lender has put pressure on me to meet a value. So that's not going to happen. The enforcement arm of the HVCC is the IVPI, which is the Independent Value Protection Institute, which has been neither funded nor staffed. So who protects the consumer? You do. How? Give us a bill with a mechanism for enforcement that has sharp teeth and put it in the tough but fair in capable hands of the ACLB. Other states have done it, and many states, other states are now in this process. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here today. We have four more people signed up. Mr. Martinez, do you have Mr. O'Brien here with you? Please come forward. And then the next two up will be Mr. Jillians and Mr. Marquis.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association, as well as the United Financial Lobby, which, to remind the committee, is the banks, the credit unions, mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, consumer finance companies. We are all opposed to the bill in its current form. I would just, as a little bit of background, it certainly, the real estate crisis has certainly harmed millions of people, whether you're a homeowner, a bank that's now closed, a realtor who's no longer in the business. We had over 15,000 mortgage brokers in this state at the height, and we narrowed down to 4,400. And the appraisers obviously are struggling as well. So everybody is struggling as a result of the real estate crisis. We don't believe that the bill before you establishes a program that we can support. We're not opposed to the idea of it. In fact, I think I have an appointment with you later today, Mr. Chairman, to talk about some proposed amendments. You heard from the appraisers just now, and it sounds like several of them are licensed in both Oregon and Washington. We believe that the Washington bill, after a lot of negotiation with all the stakeholders, is a good bill, and it's something we could support and would support. I think that the real fundamental issue before you is where this board or who will oversee these companies. We strongly believe that the appraisal board is not the right place. It's the analogy I would give, it's kind of like the employees overseeing the employers. And I don't know too many state boards or agencies that do that, because basically what you'd have is the appraisers overseeing the folks that they work for. We strongly believe it ought to be in DCBS. Now, DCBS doesn't seem to want it, But, you know, there are numerous examples. We've all of you are senior members of the legislature of programs going to agencies that may not have actually wanted it, but it was the right place to go, and we believe that DCBS is the right place for this program. I will defer to Mr. O'Brien. I do have a copy of the Washington bill. It just passed again on 215, so basically last week. No, this week. But it is something we could live with. California has adopted a similar bill. Idaho is in the process of adopting it, and you'll hear from Mr. O'Brien as he's been working in about 20 states on this issue. And again, this is a good bill. We did not have the opportunity on the House. We suggested to Representative Holvey that putting a work group together would be helpful. Well, we offered to do that in the interim and just do a very basic bill that would start the registration process, but put together a work group. We've seen success in that in the mortgage issues in the last couple of years, but he felt he needed to move the bill that you have before us or before you. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and turn it over to Mr. O'Brien.
Okay. Go to Mr. O'Brien and then to question.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is Timothy O'Brien. I'm a certified residential real estate appraiser. I work for RELS Valuation. We are the largest appraisal management company in the country. I represent an interest of appraisal management companies through our trade organization, TAVMA. I am recognized as a subject matter expert in the terms of AMC registration throughout the country. As the previous testimony had stated, there were six bills that were passed last year with a seventh pending. There are approximately 30 bills working right now throughout the country. I'm involved in all of them. I worked closely with the Washington group. I wrote a part of the bill. So I've come on behalf of the bankers and on behalf of the chair and his committee to be a resource to answer any questions that I may and to offer some specific testimony. Senator Holvey spoke very eloquently. I do have to correct him on a couple of items, though, with all respect. The federal government did not pass the Home Valuation Code of Conduct. It is an agreement between the AG's office in New York and the GSEs, Fannie, Freddie, and later HUD. It has not caused an instability in the appraisal industry. To refute direct testimony, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have come and said since the institution of the Home Valuation Code of Conduct, appraisal quality has increased. In terms of AMC's raising fees under the appraisal management or under Home Valuation Code of Conduct, that is also incorrect. That is anecdotal evidence that is supported with no information. I have surveys through our group showing that the fees charged by appraisal management companies have remained stable under the Home Valuation Code of Conduct since before it was instituted. The true nature of the reason why fees are going down is something that Mr. Martinez represented, an oversupply in the market. 2003-2004 saw a huge influx of appraisers, mortgage brokers, everyone into the industry. There is currently an oversupply of appraisers versus the demand for appraisal assignments right now. The market has recognized that, and fees have adjusted accordingly. HUD has looked at this issue through a recent FAQ and refuses to set fees. They have stated that fees will be set by the marketplace between the appraisers and the groups that they engage. In addition, HVCC does not mandate the use of appraisal management companies. Nowhere in that document does it say that banks have to use appraisal management companies. They have the option to outsource the function or to develop a function internally that is separate from their production center. Overall, we are not opposed to a bill. I have worked, as I had said, in many states to work with a bill. The Washington bill is a very good model of stakeholders coming together. Unfortunately, the stakeholder group that Senator Holvey put together did not include the bankers or large appraisal management companies through our trade organization. This is disappointing because we could have probably resolved a lot of these issues before the last day needing to be heard in front of you here today. We would like to make a bill that makes sense. We feel that housing it under DCBS is more appropriate than the appraisal board. We are corporations. The appraisal board licenses individuals right now. There is no experience to license corporations under this under the appraisal board. Other states, including Washington, have not put this under the appraisal board. Although the first bills that were passed in 2009 put them under the appraisal board, we are seeing the biggest amount of concern and potential lawsuits as it regards to being under the appraisal board, the appraisal board not understanding the AMC model. With respect to the gentleman testifying from the board, it sounds like there are some questions they don't understand about appraisal management companies. We need to have those represented and appropriately seen by the overseeing board. The bill that's before you doesn't address many of the things that the group has come forward to testify on. There's nothing to say about fees in this bill at all. There's nothing about consumer protection. This does not protect consumers as it's written today, opposed to, say, the Washington bill. As Senator Hovey also said, there's no surety bond. There's no other levels of things that he wanted that was negotiated into the Washington bill. We feel the Washington bill is a much more better template to work with opposed to the bill that currently is in front of this committee. The current bill will most likely be amended in the 2011 session because there sounds like there are many things that need to still be addressed. We would prefer to have a bill that's done right so we can offer a couple of items and either be a member of a stakeholder board, work to get a bill similar to Washington that addresses these issues. The largest concern, though, is we have not been represented in the process. Our company's been doing business in Oregon for 25 years. Not only do we employ full-time appraisers as employees, we have our office that oversees our Pacific Northwest operations located in Bend. We have been a part of your communities. We have been working with your realtors, with your appraisers, and I believe the comment was that there were 70-some-odd emails supporting this bill. That doesn't represent the whole of the appraisers in Oregon. We have a significant amount of appraisers who oppose this bill as well, and we believe their voices should be heard as well. I'm happy to answer any questions that the chair may have or any members of the committee.
Questions? I did have a question, Mr. O'Brien. I'm going to ask this and try to ask it in just a fairly objective fashion. While supply and demand affects a lot of issues, consumers depend upon the appraisal of a property in making probably their primary investment of a lifetime. At some point, if supply and demand is all that's in play, the cost of the service can get down to a point that affects the quality of the service. For instance, if there was an oversupply of surgeons, I wouldn't necessarily want to go to the cheapest surgeon that was out there. How do you try to ensure the underlying quality of the appraisals?
Mr. Chairman, not only do we house an internal quality control department staffed by members of the Appraisal Institute and some of the highest designated members in the country, we have a full quality control process with our lender partners as well. I'm actually audited three different ways, for the record. Not only do my lender and other partner audit me, we're audited in an individual third-party audit on our process as well. My lender partner, who I work with, and for full disclosure, we handle the needs of Wells Fargo's appraisal process. They have no interest in bad appraisals. We have quality control department. Our QC department is then quality controlled by their QC department. There's a significant level of quality control already in the industry. I do agree, though, that the Home Valuation Code of Conduct has seen a new entrance into the model, new opportunistic companies that may have joined the AMC community, and they may not have the same level of quality control that an organization like mine does. I'm particularly concerned that this bill may exempt them. The bill in front of you has several exemptions that would take some of the smallest, some of the biggest offenders out of this bill. Why would you not want to include all entities that provide appraisal management services? Previous testimony stated that appraisal management companies are the only member of the chain that are not licensed and or regulated. That's not exactly true. Appraisal firms and shops that may be owned by appraisers, although they're licensed individually by the board, have no overstanding license for the appraisal management services they provide. For example, if I run an appraisal shop and I tell or instruct one of my appraisers in the ways of undue influence that is talked in this bill, you can attack the appraiser who does the appraisal for doing a poor appraisal, but can you shut my shop down? No, you can't. Not under the current bill and the way it's structured. We feel under the definition of this bill, how appraisal management services are provided, all companies offering that entity, regardless of scale or employment nature, should be subject to the bill.
Additional questions?
Could you name some specifics of people who are not included by the bill that should be?
Certainly, Senator. I can reference the actual bill if you like, or just give an overview. Which would you prefer?
Just some specifics so I know what you're...
Certainly. One exemption is companies that do 10 or less appraisals in Oregon a year. First of all, this is logistically difficult because how many appraisals do you know you're going to do in January when you may have to register? These are the companies that probably are the out-of-state or the very small that are not connected to your community. They are probably the ones that have the least incentive to play by the rules at this point. Another would be appraisers that oversee appraisal management services in their firm. Again, they are regulated as individual appraisers, but not for the management services they provide. And those are the two largest exemptions that would be of concern. These exemptions were removed from the Washington bill for these specific concerns at the discussion of their committee chairs, and they felt that any entities providing appraisal management services, large or small, should be subject to the same level of registration or licensure.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you both for coming.
Thank you for the time.
Mr. Gilliams and Mr. Markey. And if there's anyone else wanting to testify, please let us know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Markey. I'm here today representing the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. We are the Oregon affiliate of Mortgage Bankers of America. Primarily represent lenders in Oregon, mortgage lenders. We are not opposed, our organization is not opposed to the regulation of AMCs and would encourage you to continue looking at this issue. However, we have some major concerns about House Bill 3624 as it's drafted. We've appeared in front of the House and we've met with Representative Holby and we just continue to disagree as to some what we consider very important things in the bill. The serious question here is where this regulation should lie. And I know that Tori Streisinger told Representative Holby that she doesn't think they have the expertise to do this at DCBS. I teased my friend Lou Savage that never stopped them before, but... We really do think they could do the job over there. Our concern about the appraiser board, I guess I should just tell you a story. We had at a meeting, a conference call meeting of our legislative committee a few weeks ago, we invited one of the members of the appraisal board to be on that call to explain this legislation and the need for it. And after going through the provisions of the bill and explaining his point of view, he said at the end of the day, bottom line, we need to regulate AMCs to stop them from this practice of hiring incompetent appraisers. Well, I checked the statutes, and guess what? The appraiser board is in charge of making sure appraisers are competent. And one of our members asked if these people are hiring unlicensed appraisers, and certainly they're not. The issue was presented as they're hiring appraisers from outside the geographic area, and okay, if this is an issue, then why doesn't the appraiser board adopt rules about knowledge of the geographic area? I think they have that authority. And I was told in a subsequent meeting that they're now looking at doing that. I don't think, and my organization doesn't think, that the appraiser board is the proper venue to have these people regulated. We think it needs to be outside of there. This is, in my personal view, this is an absolute case of be careful what you ask for. The appraisers have continued to be concerned about undue pressure, and I'm sure that at times there have been undue pressure put on appraisers to over-appraise or under-appraise a piece of property. The only way that works is if somebody says yes. And I suggested at one point in these discussions that maybe we ought to just make it a felony for an appraiser to knowingly over or under appraise a piece of property. That might really solve the problem.
It would have a significant fiscal, Mr. Markey.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ways and Means Committee isn't all bad, as you showed earlier. So, So I'll stop there. I just continue to have concerns about where this regulation lies, and be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Jillians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Pleasure to be here, kind of in the middle, Mr. Chair, of all our friends in the real estate industry, the banks and the appraisers, where we all typically work together, but we do have a few disagreements here, and we've tried to be the middle ground as far as getting something to move forward, and ultimately our interest is protecting the end consumer, which I think everyone in the long run wants that, but specifically in this case, that's our biggest interest in dealing with the HVCC and the regulation of AMCs. First of all, Mr. Chair, I would say we strongly want AMCs registered and regulated in this state. Our national association has taken a position that every state should have registration and regulations over AMC companies. I'll disagree slightly with Mr. O'Brien on the positive impacts of the HVCC on the appraisal industry and what we've seen to the end consumer. In fact, our national association has met 5 times with Attorney General Cuomo to try and get him to roll back the HVCC, and we've introduced a bill in Congress to put an 18-month moratorium on the HVCC because we are concerned about the unintended consequences of what happened with the HVCC. I would agree with Mr. Marquis on the location of where this regulation should occur. All along, we have stated that DCBS is the proper venue for this regulation. They are business entities. The appraiser board oversees individual licensees, and DCBS typically register or regulates business entities, and that's what we're dealing with here. Representative Holvey was very forthcoming, and he did take into account a lot of our concerns and amendments on the House side. I think that's the one sticking point that we never could agree on, that we all thought DCBS was the appropriate place. And when Ms. Streisinger said that she didn't feel they had the expertise, he went with her opinion. But my point to him, Mr. Chair and members, was that if you put in statute what they're supposed to enforce, they'll know what they're supposed to be enforcing. And I think a bill putting forth what they should be looking for as far as these business entities and how they interact with independent contractors, it would be appropriate. There's been a lot of mention today of the Washington language that came forth. Our state association, Washington, was intimately involved in that, Mr. Chair. They started down the same path as we did in a condensed session. They wanted to get something done. They felt it was necessary. They put the brakes on, and then they all worked together, got into a room, beat it out, and finally did come up with compromise language. It passed their house 98-0 because everyone was in support. If we went forward, and I know it's very late in the process, Mr. Chair, but if we did go forward with the Washington language, we would be supportive of that, Mr. Chair. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Marquis or Mr. Jillians? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
if I could my testimony, I don't mean to in any way to disparage the work of the appraiser board or the good work that appraisers do in this state. I just think this is a real serious policy disagreement about where this regulation ought to lie.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Marquis. Representative Holvey, I've seen that you have returned to the hearing room here. Did you wish to come forward? And again, identify yourself for the record, even though I just stated your name.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative Paul Holvey from District 8. I appreciate the opportunity. I just wanted to add a few pieces of clarification, perhaps. Mr. Martinez had stated on the floor in a letter, and I corrected it on the floor on the House side, and again in this committee, that the credit unions are opposed to this bill. And I just spoke with Pam Leavitt outside, and they are not opposed to this bill. So I just wanted to make sure that was on the record. And as well, as far as the process of how we got here, you know, as I said, there's a banker on the board of the Appraisal Licensure Board that's been working on this issue for quite some time. I had a public hearing on this. Mr. O'Brien from RELS did not testify in that. He has not contacted my office to talk to me about this bill. I have met with Tim Martinez, Jim Marquis, in January as well about this bill and asked them what give me some pieces of this bill that you could agree to. They came back to me on February 5th. I had another stakeholder meeting with them, the realtors, and discussed this bill. He gave me some pieces of a bill that they would agree to. But unfortunately, all it did was register and put some parameters and standards in for appraisal management companies with no penalties, no enforcement, and that would be like giving a good housekeeping seal to companies with no regulation because there's no enforcement. And so I took some pieces out of the bill, which I wanted in the bill based on their recommendations. The bond, the surety bond was one of them, and several other pieces. So I did attempt to engage the stakeholder group that is evidently saying that they haven't been a part of this. If they haven't been a part of it, it is because they have not been, coming forward fast enough, as this process does move pretty fast, to engage me on this. And I just wanted to clarify that for the record. And the fact that there's no pieces of a consumer protection in here, I think, is not actually correct. There's a piece in here that allows the consumer to ask for a reevaluation of the appraisal result in here if he has a problem with the result, a sort of a due process for requesting that there be other comparables looked at. That was a piece that was brought forward by Representative Wisnett on the other side of the building. And the fact that the entire integrity of valuation is absolutely central to consumers in making sure their values are accurate and are done so according to the standards that appraisers operate under. And I don't have a lot of problem with the Washington State model of this bill. This bill is very, very similar to it. The big issue is, of course, a lot of folks would like to see this housed at Department of Consumer and Business Services. My conversations with them kept coming back to the same conclusion that there's so much in regulating appraisal management companies that deals with appraisals and appraisers that it made sense that it fall under the Appraisal Licensure Board. I thank you for the added clarification opportunity.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Representative Holvey. Anyone else that wishes to testify at this point that hasn't testified? Okay. Conclude the public hearing, and that concludes our business for this morning. I believe the committee will be back in at 2 p.m. this afternoon.
We'll get the agenda, actually.
For the sake just of the committee, we have a number of items up on the agenda, but the last item will be the religious attire, religious dress.
Have you informed Senator Courtney that he might be needed?
Well,
oh, he won't be needed for that.
Oh,
it's just a public hearing.
It's just a public hearing. I thought, are mics on? I thought you were referring to Senator.